tonight on Arena. Cáitse Reardon asks, where do I begin with Patti Smith? And curator June Caldwell on the new Nuala O'Fuilleann exhibition at Museum of Literature Ireland. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Patti Smith is an American poet, author, musician, singer, songwriter and activist who has been referred to in the past as the Poet Laureate of Punk. Her debut album, Horses, released 45 years ago in 1975, established her as a hugely influential figure in the burgeoning punk rock movement in New York of the 1970s. She has remained active ever since, winning a National Book Award in 2010 for her memoir, Just Kids, and she's widely regarded to this day as an icon in music circles, as well as an activist in the anti-war movement, on climate issues and on the political stage. So, to answer a question we often ask here on a Tuesday night on Arena, where do I begin with? I'm joined with by musician Cáitse Reardon, who has been considering the work and the legacy of Patti Smith, and where do I begin with Patti Smith? You didn't begin too well with Patti Smith, it has to be said, did you? You know?
It's so funny that I was invited in to talk about Patti, because I hated her. When I was a teenager, I was born in 65. So when I first started paying attention to what was happening outside of, say, the Wombles or the Glitter Band and Slade, she'd gone through the Horses era, and she was at the Easter era, which would be her third album, which had an album cover of her basically sniffing her armpit and the hairs all out. And to me, at 13, she just looked like all the smelly hippies who had upset me when I was growing up. That's the big, my Proustian olfactory memory is smelly hippies. I didn't get, you know, Madeleines and linden blossom tea. It was like, I was just the wrong age. And I think somebody at nursery school scarred me for life. And they must have looked like Patti, because Patti just triggered this aversion response. So I just said, nope, no, nuh-uh. Don't want anything to do with Patti Smith. And I just ignored her.
Purely on the basis of smell?
Purely on the basis of the way she looked reminded me of smelly hippies.
Well, I mean, I'm just thinking about around that time then, you know, other female artists who were out there, obviously Debbie Harry and Blondie or Chrissy Hynde and the Pretenders, were they in a very different world in your mind than Patti Smith?
Completely, completely. Patti Smith looked old to me. And weirdly enough, Debbie Harry looked young. But then again, Debbie Harry didn't look terrestrial. She looked otherworldly. And I have a very clear memory in the same year that Patti Smith was having her big crossover hit, a girl came into school and said, Debbie Harry is 30. And we just went, no, she can't be. Because to us, 30 was impossibly ancient. Our parents were 30. God. And Debbie Harry just looked young and vibrant. Yeah, yeah. And Chrissy Hynde too. I totally recognise Chrissy Hynde. You know, I was raised by a rocker and my big brother was a rocker, and Chrissy was a very recognisable, cool type to me. And again, poor old Patti just fell on the wrong side. Hippies weren't cool.
Yeah, and Patti Smith seeming old seems ridiculous, because she still seems young to me today.
She's
as
so
young as she
alive.
Did back
yeah.
then. Yeah, but it was the memoir in 2010. Then Just Kids. That was that was a big turning point for you, was it?
It really was. Like I said, I just decided to ignore Patti Smith. I never had any need for Patti Smith in my life. And then in 2010, I start reading all these reviews and hearing from people whose opinion I respect and admire. So, have you read Patti Smith's book? Or Patti Smith's new memoir is the book of the year. And I saw it enough times, I just thought, Patti Smith? With, you know, the hairy armpit, scarecrow, shouty, yelly lady. Ah. But it was the fact that it was a memoir of her relationship with Robert Mapplethorpe, who's, you know, a huge, towering artistic figure in his own right. I thought, this is not going to be boring. So I took the plunge. I waited till the paperback came out and I bought it and I read it. And I, you know, they say I couldn't put it down, because she's talking about stuff that I had read about through other people that I admired. She lived in the Chelsea Hotel, like Leonard Cohen or, you know, Dylan Thomas, Brendan Behan. So, whoa, she lived in the Chelsea Hotel. She was mentored by Allen Ginsberg, again, another huge figure. Anne Waldman was the she's contemporary with Anne Waldman, who was the woman poet who went out on the road with Dylan. She was coeval at the Bowery Poetry Project with Jim Carroll, who was a famous writer who wrote Basketball Diaries and had a big rock hit with These Are People Who Died. I just thought, oh, hang on a sec. She's not a hippie.
There's something else going on here.
She's a punk.
Yeah.
And, you know, all along, all artists I liked have been saying, Horses, what's your favourite album? Horses, you know, who's your favourite woman musician? Patti Smith, have you heard Horses? And so I was like, okay, I have to listen to Horses.
I better start with Horses.
I better, because everyone
which was her, it was her debut album.
It was her debut album, but she'd already was halfway through a decade of a career as a performing noted poet.
Mm.
And that's a very important thing, again, that made me realign my assessment of her. She's the same type as Cohen, who, of course, started as a poet and then at some point just felt the muse telling him to blend in music. And Patti Smith took the same path. Patti Smith met up with a record store guy called Lenny Kay, who was just, I love Lenny. I've always loved Lenny, which is really weird. Mm. Maybe I'm jealous and that's why I didn't like Patti. Lenny, again, was kind of a hippie guy, but he was more famous for kind of bringing garage rock to the punk bands. Garage rock would have been the 60s proto punk rockers, the stuff that would have informed the music Iggy Pop and the Stooges. And he's a huge Them fan, Van Morrison's Them fan, and like Rocky Erickson and 13th Floor Elevators. And he bought all this stuff to Patti and just started jamming these long jams they'd used to do. They got on great. She was a great poet. He was a lovely guy and a nice musician. And he kept it very simple for her. And she's always said he really encouraged her
right
to do these spoken word performances. And then when she got comfortable with the backing, him backing on guitar, he was nudging her gently, how about a bit of piano? So they got piano and then they brought in drums and suddenly she's in a rock and roll band. It's an amazing story.
But he moves her from poets to being in rock and roll.
To being in rock and roll, and they landed a record deal. Clive Davis caught them performing and just signed them to Arista.
The track that you've chosen from Horses, the 1975 debut album, Gloria Part 1, In a Chelsea's Day. Why this particular track?
Well, it's track one, and also it's Gloria. You'll recognise it. Gloria by Them is in there somewhere, but it's put through a very Patti Smith filter. And it's also, it's not the whole piece, because the very beginning of the poem is Patti crooning lines from a poem she'd written 5 years earlier called Oath. And the first line is jaw-dropping. When you situate it in time and it's a woman, a young woman in America, it's a stunning debut.
Anything's allowed. I'll go to this here party. Until I look out the window, see a sweet young thing hopping on the parking meter, leaning on the parking meter. Oh, she looks so good. Oh, she looks so fine.
It is quite an extraordinary line, the opening line to Gloria in a Chelsea's Day, from Patti Smith's debut album Horses, which is where Cáithnín O'Riordan is suggesting us, to us the same. This is where you start with Patti Smith. Just remind us of that opening line again.
Jesus died for somebody's sins, but not mine.
And you were saying, as we listened to that, the song was released, the album was released in 1975, but she wrote that poem, or those words were written back when she was 20, which we worked out somewhere in the mid to late 60s.
Yeah, she was born in 46, and I read somewhere she said she was 20, because of course people have always asked her, what did you mean by that? What were you saying? What was this huge declaration you made? She says, well, I was 20 when I wrote that. And it was part of this poem that she started performing when she was 70 as a spoken word, in 1970 as a spoken word piece. But I've read different things that she said about it. She said that thing, well, I was 20 and I don't even know what it meant. I just wanted to kind of say I'm free of Jesus. I didn't want Jesus worrying about me. And then later she said things like, she was raised a Jehovah's Witness by her mother, but her dad was a rebel and her dad would blaspheme and swear about God. And she said, I definitely got it from him. It was just something that I wanted to say, Jesus, you don't have to look out for me. I'll look out for myself. And again, what a fantastic thing for a young person to say. But in the context, Sean,
in
the context
of
America, which is still incredibly conservative, she how long ago is 1975? Is that like 45 years ago?
Yeah.
Whoa, the balls on that woman.
Yeah, and this was at the time very, very conservative America, you know, as maybe even more conservative than it is today. But what about the cover of that album? Because you talked about hairy armpits and potential smells putting you off.
Yeah, she's an utterly different cat on the front of Horses. Now, if I'd seen the Horses cover first
and got it differently.
I'd have said, okay, that's Patti Smith, because it's superb. And she's modelled herself on an old photo of the French poet Arthur Rimbaud, who she said was her favourite poet. And she said Mapplethorpe took the photograph. And he said to her, if you're going to wear a white shirt, and it has to be a clean shirt. And said, and that was all the art direction he gave her. So she got a clean white shirt and she found a bit of ribbon and she slung a jacket over her shoulder, which was at that time, that would signify I'm Frank Sinatra. Which again is kind of taking
miles
on.
Miles ahead of its time.
Yeah, the 400-pound gorilla of American culture at the time. She's kind of saying, oh yeah, Frank Sinatra, anyone can do that. Or I am Frank Sinatra.
And she has an androgynous look on the cover as
well. Oh, totally. She is one scrawny girl. Yeah, she. You look at her and you want to feed her soup. And she said, like, when she first met Ginsberg, it wasn't as a poet. She was in an automat. She was hungry and she didn't have enough money for a cheese sandwich. And Ginsberg saw her from behind and thought she was a boy. So I said, can I buy you something? And it was only when she spoke that he realised she was a girl. But to Ginsberg's credit, he bought her a cheese sandwich, tried to feed her up a bit. But yeah, when you see the Horses cover, she could be a boy, she could be a girl.
And again, that's very much miles ahead of us.
Oh, and of course, as you heard there, that little bit of Gloria that we heard there, she's singing, oh, she looks so fine. Patti Smith made the decision not to change the gender of the subject of Van's song, which again mixes it all up. And there's it's challenging the listener.
So Horses was the debut album, 75. Radio Ethiopia came out in 76. But the second album and the second choice that you're sending us to, Koch, is from 1978. And the album Easter. You had to change your mind about this one for sure.
Well, originally I was thinking, well, if you're going to start somewhere, would you not just start with the trilogy? But then I thought...
The trilogy being?
Well, the opening trilogy, you know, which would be Horses... And then the second album, and then the third album is Easter. And then I just thought, no, because there's another song later on I want to pick too. So let's just skip to the meat of it, which is Because the Night, which was her biggest hit. And it kind of announced it to the world outside the cool American downtown bohemian proto-punk scene. And it was a huge deal for her. It's a Bruce Springsteen skeleton of a song that she put the verses into, which was a big deal in itself, just to get a co-write with Bruce Springsteen. But what's really fascinating to me is, one, the story, the whole story about it, and then two, all the challenges it gave her about the success it had. But the story's so beautiful. It's a love story. Yeah. Bruce Springsteen, 1978, he's working on Darkness on the Edge of Town. And he's got the melody and the chorus of this song, and he's calling it Because the Night. And the guy who's engineering his album is Jimmy Iovine, who I would always associate with U2 for my generation. But back then he was engineering Bruce Springsteen, and Patti had seen him at the record plant where he worked and said, that's a hardworking guy. I'm going to get him to produce my album. And kind of in return for this big step up that Patti gave him, Jimmy decided he was going to get this song from Bruce Springsteen for Patti Smith, which is so audacious. I just love the way he was thinking. And Bruce famously said, if she can sing it, she can have it. So he did a little demo on cassette tape, children, ask granddad, and he gave it to Patti Smith, and Patti wouldn't listen to it because she was asking herself all these questions that the Clash went through, you know. What if it's a sellout? What if we're successful? People will hate us. But and she had the other dimension as well. She wanted to be known as a writer, and she wanted her band and herself to create their own work. So she went through real proper, genuine artistic struggles and, you know, integrity and everything. And of course, the Clash never went on Top of the Pops, but Patti Smith did record Because the Night. And then one night she was waiting for her boyfriend to call from Detroit. Again, children, back in the days you had to make phone dates. You couldn't just call anybody anytime for free. And because he lived so far away and she was so in love, they could only speak once a week. And their agreement was 7:30 on this particular evening of that week, he would call her, and he didn't call. And she spent hours in agony wondering where he was. This was Fred Sonic Smith, an excellent guitarist from the MC5. So she said she was pacing the room and she saw Bruce's cassette and Bruce's writing was on it. And she said something clicked. She said, I'm going to at least distract myself by listening to it. And she put it on and, you know, Bruce Springsteen singing that chorus. And she just went, oh, Lord, this is a hit song.
Man.
And she said that started boiling up in her and she was getting really upset about friends. She was getting really upset about the danger of actually being successful. Yeah. And it all just triggered a release of creativity in her. And she wrote the most passionate, incredible verses. Love is a ring on the telephone. Fred rang at midnight and she'd finished the song.
And this is what she gave us. Because the Night there from Patti Smith, the artist that Coach O'Riordan on is speaking to us about this evening. You're just loving that. And it's such an amazing chorus, actually, when you hear it there.
Amazing.
You're skipping then. 79 was the year after that album was released, Coach, and Patti Smith took a break to raise a family. Back then in 1988 with a new album, Dream of Life, and your final choice, which is People Have the Power.
Yeah.
Why is that the final choice?
Well, Fred called, they got married, they raised the family, Patti left New York, she went to Detroit. And then after this long gap of 9 years, Fred was writing songs and he decided to study Because the Night, which we just heard. He had the idea of a song and he really wanted to understand how Springsteen made Because the Night's chorus leap out from the verses and what made it such a great song. And he applied what he was learning to the song he was working on, and Patti worked on it too. And they wrote together this song called People Have the Power, which has just become an anthem. And I'm a very late comer to Patti Smith, but when I did start getting into her, it was live. I was seeing her everywhere in New York where I was working the last few years. She is everywhere. She'll pop up and read a poem, or she'll be somewhere with a full rock band, or it'll be just her and her guitar singing a few tunes, or it'll be her with Tony Shanahan, who's this American-Irish great musician she works with, and playing piano for her. She can appear in, she's like water. She's so fluid, she can do anything, but she always does People Have the Power because it is an anthem now.
Yeah, for sure it is that. What an amazing three-step introduction to Patti Smith, but I guess we should really start with the memoir. Because that's what changed your mind.
Absolutely.
Coach.
If you have an aversion to smelly looking women, read the book.
All right, that's it. Coach O'Riordan speaking to us about Patti Smith. Thanks a million for coming in to us this evening, Coach,
pleasure.
To do that. And we'll finish up with that choice of Coach's. Start with Horses, then go to Easter, then go to Dream of Life and play this track, People Have the Power.
Woo!
The people who have the power.
One of this week's big TV attractions is a new drama series starting tonight as Sky Atlantic and Now TV launch The Plot Against America. This is the six-part adaptation of Philip Roth's 2004 novel of the same name, a story that reimagines American history in the 1940s and asks, what if, instead of Franklin D. Roosevelt winning a third term as president in 1940 and thus leading to America entering World War II, the pro-fascist, anti-Semitic aviation hero Charles Lindbergh had become president? This alternative history is seen through the eyes of the Levins, a Jewish family living in Newark who watch and listen in horror as their world falls apart. The Levin family consists of father and mother, Herman and Bess, and two young boys, Sandy and Philip. But there's also a relative hanging about the house, a young man called Alvin, who's played by Irish actor Anthony Boyle, who joins me now from Belfast, in fact. I thought you were going to be in New York, Alvin, but Anthony, but you're in Belfast. Have you been there since lockdown, yeah?
Yes, we were. And then when the whole quarantine thing happened, I came back and I've been in my parents' house. So we've been watching Tiger King and Home Come Down with Me's and everything to keep us sane. So, yeah, I wish I was in New York, but unfortunately not.
But what a time you've had in New York in recent times. You know, obviously, first of all, you were there with Harry Potter and the Cursed Child, and that's when this particular project, The Plot Against America, came across your eyes. Just explain where Alvin fits into the Levin family and his role in the piece.
So Alvin is an orphan. He is a very sort of, he's got a moral compass. He cares more about being good than being liked. And he is Herman. He's his nephew. He's had to take him in when his father passed. And he struggles a lot because he falls in with a lot of sort of wayward lads. And he's not very good at holding his tongue. Philip Roth described him as emotionally the rawest of the raw. He's a guy who, you know, just can't sit still if there's an injustice about. Mm.
You mentioned Philip Roth there. Obviously, you went back then and had a look at the novel. I don't think Alvin features as much in the book as he does in the series that we see.
Mm. Yeah, it was the same with Winona's character and John Turturro's character. They were sort of on the peripheral because in the book, it's seen through the eyes of a 9-year-old boy. Or 11-year-old boy, but with this series, one of the things I think David Simon done really cleverly was he fleshed out the world, and you can get more of a complete sense of a world through the eyes of my character, and one of us and John's, than just a child who stays in Newark. Right. So we've had a full sort of back.
A couple of names that we need to clarify there. Your old friend Winona, clearly at this stage, and your old friend John Turturro and Winona Ryder. But I'm wondering what it was like for you on that first morning going in for a read-through, and you've Winona Ryder, and you've Zoe Kazan as well, and you've John Turturro, and lots of other big-name actors sitting there in that room for the first read-through of the television script. How was that intimidating in any way?
It was a bit, but I sort of... I just went in the American accent, so I was sort of wearing a mask, if you know what I mean. So I wasn't sort of going, oh, Jesus Christ, there's Winona Ryder. I was just going, I hope I don't mess this up. You know what I mean? So I felt a bit of the pressure was lifted from meeting those sort of heavyweights or whatever, from just my own insecurity, thinking I don't want to mess this job up and get fired on the first day.
And you're going in using the American accent from the very outset. Is that a kind of a method thing with you? You mean, did you stay in character? Did you speak in American accent on and off set?
I spoke in an American accent when I was good, mainly just because it was easier and I wanted to stay in. I mean, it would have been, I think, a bit jarring for everyone else if I was like, yo, what's the crack? How are we getting on? it's a bit easier if I stay from Newark, New Jersey. But I did. I went to the audition and just went in and was like, hey, what about those Mets? You know, and just tried to blag it. Unfortunately, fooled them. But yeah, but we had a good dialect coach as well. So when we started into the swing of the things, I worked with a great coach as well.
And there you go again. What about those Mets? So you were a big fan of the New York Mets and you were fully aware of everything to do with baseball, were you, Anthony Boyle?
I haven't got a clue. I still don't know the first rule. But I can act like I know, which is all that's important.
Which is what's required. Listen, I want people to hear the American accent because it's astonishing, if you don't mind my saying so. I think you really hit it on the nail, certainly to my ears. And this is quite early on. I think this is actually possibly your first appearance, or quite early on in episode one at any rate. And you're talking to who would be one of your cousins, a young boy called Sandy, played by Caleb Malice. Is that how I say Caleb's name?
And I think so.
You're working in a local garage. But as you said about Alvin, he has a bit of a bad reputation around the place. So the owner of the garage thinks that you're up to no good. Let's have a listen to the scene.
You are good.
Alvin?
What?
I stopped by the gas station. I had your sketch.
Oh, so you think I'm a thief?
No, it's just Mr. Simkowitz.
Simkowitz said I was a thief. Look, just between me and your buddy over there, I'm a lot of things, kiddo. But a thief, I'm not. You're too young to understand now, but there comes a time in a guy's life where a guy has to stick up for a friend. Even if the friend isn't always the brightest bulb. You square? All right. Now you'll have to excuse me, Picasso. There's some guys in the alley behind the barbershop and they're just begging to lose their beer money.
And that's Anthony Boyle and Caleb Malice there in a scene from the first episode of The Plot Against America, which starts tonight on Sky Atlantic and Now TV, 9 o'clock, in fact. Anthony Boyle speaking to me from Belfast. And as people have heard before we heard that clip, a very strong Belfast accent. Accents, are they generally just not a problem to you, Anthony?
I've always had a good ear for it. I've grown up doing so much UK media and so much American media, you know, just TV programmes and songs and stuff. So I think I've just always had a good ear for it.
But you know how to speak in your own accent as well. I suppose if you went home speaking with the New York accent, you'd be told.
I'd get a clip around the ear. Yeah,
and it would be a clip that you'd get around the ear, right enough. And they wouldn't have understood that if you'd said that at the first read through either. I'm guessing. We get a sense in that clip, Anthony. You know, you said to me earlier on that he's got a very strong moral compass, that it's more about being good rather than being liked. And in that clip, he talks about that loyalty to friends. Yet he is a kind of a guy who, I suppose, he speaks first, or, you know, he leaps before he thinks. He doesn't do it the other way around.
Yeah, it's that thing, you know, Roth called him emotionally Roth of the Raw. It's just, I think he's just, he's like an ape or something. You know, he just reacts first without having to think about it.
And he understands, or he certainly is more wary of the whole political situation that Roth lines out, and I suppose as a result that was outlined by David Simon and Ed Burns in the teleplay. The political situation that's set up here, it's quite a frightening one in terms of anybody who has a Jewish background.
Yeah, completely. I mean, I think when Roth wrote it in 2004, he was using the Bush administration, but what he was doing was viewing it through the lens of his own childhood and his own sort of contextualization of being Jewish. And I think that, of course, that's what the story is about. But I think if you look at it towards the current administration in America, it's what's happening to Mexicans. You know, it's what's happening to black people, brown people. It's language is where it begins with, and it's quite frightening.
Yeah, and across the six episodes, what's really impressive is how insidious it just drips away. It starts as just with small things, but by the end of the series, it's hugely problematic. Would you have fears, or do you sense fears among people in America right now of that type of path possibly being followed?
Yeah, man. I mean, when you've got the President of the United States saying Mexicans are rapists, that's, I mean, words are so powerful. And to be saying something like that on a national platform, it's terrifying, you know. And I think what the series really captures is not so much in the first few episodes, you know, how big fascism is. It's not, you know, it's not a Nazi on your front door. It's the power of words and how the banality of horror can just creep up on people. It's, yeah, it's very frightening.
Going into the series then, I'm just wondering what kind of background research you did on the whole Jewish community aspect of it, because this is set in Newark and it's very definitely a very strong Jewish community. Religion is there to a certain extent, but maybe not everybody is a practicing Jew. It's there in the background. Did you look into that side of things to help you in understanding, Alvin?
I did, yeah. I really wanted to honour that because, you know, not just as playing American, I was playing a Jewish person, and I felt that I really wanted to do that a service. So I was like knocking about with like these Jewish professors and like rabbis and stuff, and just I was more interested in the cultural aspect as opposed to the religious aspect, because Alvin says he's an atheist, he doesn't believe in God, but to be culturally Jewish, I think it leaves such an imprint on who you are as a human being. And I wanted to honour that. So I just, I went and done Passover and just learned about all different things. And it's actually a very similar culture I found to Irish culture. I was fascinated by it. So I grew up going to Mass all the time. My dad used to bring us on Sundays. So I love theology and I love stories and mythology and all that. So it was interesting to see the crossovers between the two.
And the other aspect that really struck me is the sense of community that there is amongst all of the families in Newark, and not all of them from a Jewish tradition either. Some beautiful mixes with Italian immigrants who have come into the area as well.
Oh, yeah.
But that sense of community was very strongly there. Did you recognise that from growing up in West Belfast, maybe cousins in and out of each other's houses, friends and neighbours in and out of each other's houses?
Definitely, man. You know, I grew up in my granny's and my auntie's and in my house, you know, and the door was always open. It felt like the world that we were building in Plot wasn't a million miles away from my upbringing. So it was, there was definitely similarities there.
Obviously, the period that we're talking about, though, in the case of the plot against America, we're back in wartime. We're back in the 1940s, as I said. What aspects of that playing in a period piece were the most challenging for you?
I think it's the biggest difference is between like how they consume media. I mean, for us, you go on Twitter and everything that's happening on the world is just, you know, the supercomputer that's in your pocket immediately. Whereas they have to go to see they have to go to the movies to see the reels, the weekly updates, and they're usually a week behind. So there's a feeling, I think, of helplessness from Alvin, who wanted to go and join the war effort, seeing his people be brutalized on screen and knowing that it had already happened. It was a week ago, you know. I think that was one of the driving forces that drove him to go to war.
Yeah, the Pathé news reels, the radio and the newspaper playing much more important role possibly than any of those media play in today's world.
Yeah, yeah.
Just going back to when you were in New York playing in Cursed Child, Harry Potter and the Cursed Child, which is kind of the Harry Potter generation too. You playing Scrobius Malfoy, the son of Drago, isn't it, from the actual books and from the original films and all of that. What was it like being on? Because I know you finished up, and a week later you were shooting this series, which is a lovely thing for an actor to get. But playing on Broadway, what was that feeling like? What was that? What sense did you get of Broadway as a community?
Broadway just felt like an absolute rock concert. You know, it was every night going out and playing to 2,000 people that were just, you know, a lot of them had waited years before they had found out what had happened in the eighth part of the story. So to be able to go out and get, like, such a special thing. You know, it was like going out and performing a season finale of Game of Thrones or The Sopranos. You know, it felt like a real gift. Mm.
And you had the live audience in front of you. It suggests to me that despite the success, and I think The Plot Against America will be a success for you without any doubt. I mean, you were also part of Derry Girls, we shouldn't forget. David Donnelly, breaking poor Aaron's heart as you were there. But despite those television successes and the television success that seems to be in front of you, is theatre the kind of the first love?
I mean, sort of. I mean, I got into acting just through watching films like Ken Loach films and Shane Meadows films and things, but you know, theatre is where I sort of first done. You know, I left drama school and done that play, and I sort of made I done well at that, you know, and I'd love to people sitting beside each other without worrying they're going to, you know, that'll be first thing on my list, try and get a theatre job, get back to it.
maybe something.
Finally, Anthony, to go back to The Plot Against America, it struck me as I watched the final episode, it may not be Philip Roth's novel, but there's more in this family. Is there any talk of further seasons?
Not that I'm aware of, no. I think you'd have to tweet David Simon and ask him. I don't think I'm privy to that information.
Well, I would love to tweet David Simon and find that out, and love to find out what role you would be playing in season two. But great to speak with you this evening. Thanks very much for talking to us. That's Anthony Boyle there, star of The Plot Against America. And as Anthony mentioned, radio does play a big part in the series and different forms of media than today. Billy Carter, as the voice of Walter Winchell, is very important in the action that takes place. And here he is giving his opinion on the aforementioned Charles Lindbergh.
Flash, Mineola, New York. Herr Lindbergh's announcement yesterday that he's seeking to become the Republican nominee for president and to challenge Franklin Roosevelt on an isolationist, pro-fascist platform has revealed the lone eagle to be the lone ostrich, sticking his head in the sand to avoid the terrible threat facing our great nation. It appears Herr Lindbergh wants to be the second Neville Chamberlain, and like Chamberlain, he swallowed hook, line, and sinker the lie that Hitler and the vicious thugs around him are eager to turn their swords into plowshares. Sorry, Herr Lindbergh, peace for our time cannot be bought with words on a piece of paper, and the American people won't be fooled. Flash, Berlin. Herr Hitler and Hermann Goering are slapping hands together and jumping around with delight, knowing they bought Herr Lindbergh with a cheap Nazi medal and a pack of lies.
Now, you had Billy Carter as Walter Winchell from The Plot Against America. Earlier we were speaking to Anthony Boyle, who stars in that six-part series. The Plot Against America begins on Sky Atlantic and Now TV tonight at 9 p.m. Just gone 14 minutes to 8 on Tuesday night's Arena. Somebody, Nuala O'Fallon, and A Book That Changed Us is the title of an upcoming exhibition at the Museum of Literature Ireland, Molly, that celebrates the enduring influence of Are You Somebody?, the groundbreaking memoir Nuala O'Fallon published in 1996. The exhibition is curated by June Caldwell, who joins me on the line now. Why was Are You Somebody so remarkable when it was first published in 1996, do you think, June?
Well, I think it's one of those books that we all remember. It's one of those books that's placed in time. It was actually published the same month and year that the last Magdalen Laundry shut in Ireland. And it was a year in which there was so much change taking place. And Nuala O'Fallon was already charting that change in her columns. But it was when she went in to contextualize a book of those columns with a personal essay about where she was placed within this society that was changing so utterly, that we got this accidental memoir. And I just think it blew the top off Ireland at the time. It really did. I think it's one of those books that everybody remembers reading. And if they didn't read it then, they certainly read it in the years after. I don't know one person who hasn't read that book.
Yeah.
So the whole idea of the exhibition was to kind of check in with the influence of that book. Let's have a look at the text. Let's see how it influenced us as a people, as writers, as women who lived in that time. And let's see where we are now in terms of the text and if it's still relevant. And that's what I wanted to set out to do.
You started reading Nuala O'Fallon. You wrote a foreword to a republication of Are You Somebody? You started reading Nuala O'Fallon in the Irish Times in her columns there as a teenager. How did she speak to you particularly at that time?
Absolutely. I just thought she was always a very risque writer. Like, I only read her very briefly as a teenager. I moved away and I was living outside of Ireland for 7 years in London in those formative years, like from age 18 to 25. It was when I moved back to Ireland, I used to read her more specifically to try and land myself back in the country and find out about really a country I'd probably in some ways run away from and didn't really know anymore. And Nuala completely grounded me in, because she wrote so across the board about, you know, social life, political life, women's lives. She wrote about men, women, children, everything in all kind of facets of society. And she wrote across class as well. So I found her columns really, really grounding. And then, you know, I was thinking about this today, that Nuala might not have even ever written that memoir, and she still would have been absolutely brilliant in what she did for us as a people in her writing and with her writing. But that memoir then was just the cake icing, really. It just, yeah, it just was unbelievable at the time. Multi-layered.
When did you first meet Niall O'Phelan?
I was, I was a Lily White journalism student. I was doing a postgrad in DIT and I thought I'd be really brave and try and go and interview somebody slightly terrifying that I didn't know, like somebody that would be a challenge. You know, it was too easy to just walk into a local shop around town and maybe do a life piece about somebody. I wanted to try and challenge myself. So I wrote off to her at the Irish Times. It was a couple of months after the book came out and I didn't expect to get a reply whatsoever. But she sent a postcard back saying that, you know, yes, I'll do an interview with you. I don't know if I'll be any way useful to you, but of course I can do this interview. And that was it. I was around in her kitchen one Sunday afternoon a couple of weeks later. And I was just so petrified, you know, because she's, whilst being very, very charming, she can also be quite terrifying as well. She was just so smart. She was frying a big pan of sausages. I hadn't got the nerve to tell her I was a vegetarian. So she was frying me all these sausages. And
did you eat the sausages?
Yeah, I didn't. I had to tell her. I actually had to say to her, Niall, I'm so sorry. You know, I don't eat sausages. Oh, for God's sake, you're not one of those. And we sat down and settled into an interview that was absolutely brilliant. You know, it was a couple of hours of she actually went further than some of the details in the book, and I did promise I'd never use those details, and I haven't. You know, I did use some of the interview later on, ironically, as part of her obituary that I wrote.
Yeah, you wrote her obituary in the Guardian at the time.
That's right, one of them.
But would your timing for that interview, you couldn't have in some ways picked a worse time, or maybe it was a good time to go to see her?
Well, do you know what? I didn't even think that through, but we stayed in touch for all the years afterwards by email. I went to one of her book launches, the first novel that came out. But apart from that, I just kept in touch with her by email. So I was very surprised when New Ireland asked me to write an introduction. I was like, look, I don't think really, I think you could find somebody a lot better. But they wanted to make it relevant to young people now, and to see kind of new eyes on the work. And that's basically what the exhibition is about too. It's about looking at the influence of the work and seeing who it really moved and why. And it's been a big set of surprising results what we've got now in this exhibition. And, you know, there's young people who've only read it recently who find it absolutely relevant to the island they're living in, which surprised me. And also just to keep in touch with family and people who knew her and say, you know, how did the book affect your life afterwards? Yeah. And, you know, where are we now? Is it still something that we need to read and learn from?
You were wary about approaching the curatorship at all. You didn't want to come across as, oh, I'm her best friend. That was one thing that you were very anxious that you didn't do. Was there any sense that there were, in other ways, giants on your shoulders, commentators and people who had either spoken with Niall O'Phelan or spoken about or written about her, that you had to follow through or had to follow up that in some way?
What I didn't want to do was, because there'd been a number of documentaries done that were brilliant and very concrete, and I felt they were very expert. It was all expert voices. And whilst obviously I have some very, very well-known people in the exhibition now, I also wanted to touch base with you know, researchers who had worked with Niall. I got in touch with an ex-student of hers who was back in UCD when Niall was only 26 and lecturing, and this woman would have only been 18. You know, I wanted to find new influences and people who just, you know, could not believe the book when it came out versus the person that they knew or thought they knew. So it's really about looking at that timeline of influence and following it through. I do, of course, have some amazing voices. Obviously, Anne Enright, who states quite frankly that Niall was an influence in her own work in fiction and otherwise. And people like Nora Casey as well, she found her to be very much a leader for women in her lifetime and encouraged her to be very honest about her experiences. And modern day essayists like Emily Pine, for instance, who would have cited Niall as a very important influence. Yeah.
Let's listen to what Anne Enright had to say, or this is part of what Anne Enright had to say, and this is part of the exhibition.
Well, like everyone in Ireland, I ate that book. I mean, everybody read it. We couldn't believe it. It was a bit like Knausgård in Norway. People were reading it at the bus stop saying, is this the person we meet, we see on the TV? Is it, you know, such a small society to bring out a little bomb of a book like that? And the first reading was a kind of intense moment of gossip making. You couldn't believe she was saying these things about her family. She was breaking. It was late night talk. It was the kind of thing you might hear from somebody in bed or in a, you know, in a confessional or in a pub. It was absolutely untrammeled and amazing. And so I read it just as that. I read it as gossip. And I put it down. I was really cross with her. There's not a lot of anger in the book. It's very kinetic. It's a very, you know, it's very hard to read it and stay still. And what agitated me was how brutally hard she was on her own mother.
And that's Anne Enright there, who is whose voice will be heard as part of the exhibition Somebody, Nuala O'Fallon, and A Book That Changed Us, which is opening at the Museum of Literature Ireland. Molly, curated by June Caldwell from July the 20th, and June is speaking with me on the line this evening. I mean, Anne brings up an interesting point there about how annoyed and how angry she got with her. Nuala O'Fallon was one of those people who was spiky and who was difficult at times. Do we have difficult people now doing the type of job that Nuala O'Fallon did back in her day?
I think it was, well, yeah, she was also a very difficult person, but she was also, she had no filter and no boundaries. We've talked about that before, but she was also utterly brilliant. I mean, it's multifaceted what she does in the work. She's talking about the great generational disappointments that women of, say, her parents' generation went through. She's also talking about her own experience. One of the participants, Yvonne Nolan, says that the book is like the portrait of the artist as a young woman. That's, it's Nuala's version of that. You know, how did somebody like Nuala carve out a career in a very patriarchal society where the roles for women were very defined and you didn't break them? And then she's also, you know, charting her own personal, very, very personal experience in love and passion and life and that kind of, you know, searching for happiness and did she ever get there and all of that. So it makes for very uncomfortable reading. And I think that's where good art comes from at the end of the day. If somebody writes something that can get an emotional reaction from you, then they have achieved something immense. And that's what Nuala does on every page of this book.
Yeah. And in fact, you're mentioning that part of the exhibition, the idea of the exhibition is the effect that it had on all of these writers, some of them better known and less known than each other, obviously. But I think it's also, also interesting to think about the effect that the book had on Nuala O'Fallon herself. And let's remind ourselves of that, the landmark interview, famous interview with Marion Finucane just before Nuala O'Fallon's death. This interview took place in April 2008, and this is how Marion Finucane started the interview.
Nuala O'Fallon, you've been on the programme a number of times in connection with your writing, and you wrote your memoir, Are You Somebody? In a way that it seemed it explained yourself to you. And now you're doing this interview in a completely different context, and I understand it is to explain yourself to yourself as well as to us as well.
Yeah, it must look as if I'm an awful devil for publicity altogether. And in a sense, I am, in that since I wrote Are You Somebody and it reached what it is the truth to say was a huge response, I have, in a sense, put myself out there. And the interviews I did back then, 10 or 11 years ago, are like one bookend in which I presented myself. And lots of people didn't like me, and lots of people did. But one way or another, it was company for me, who happens to be a childless, middle-aged woman. And now I'm actually dying. And I have metastatic cancer in three different parts of my body, and somehow or other it helps me to set up the other bookend and to say to those people who were interested in me and did care about me, well, this is how it is for me now, for what it's worth.
Niall O'Whelan speaking to Marion Finucan back in April 2008. And of course, very sad that neither of them are with us now. I'm speaking with June Caldwell this evening about Somebody, Niall O'Whelan, and a book that changed, this new exhibition at the Museum of Literature Ireland that June has curated. One of the things that you're very keen on, just as we finish on this, June, is that this isn't a retrospective. You want to talk about the enduring relevance of the book.
Yeah, and the legacy of the book, and it's going to continue. And the book is still an incredible read. Every time I read it, I get something new out of it. People are still being influenced by this book. It's very, very relevant. It's going to continue to be so. And it's also a roadmap for women in Ireland to find out if you want to become an artist or carve out your own way. You know, this is the stepping stones that can be taken. And it's as well as being a really brutal autobiography, you know. So I'm very excited about the exhibition, and I'm really excited to see what people will think.
Yeah, and of course we will actually be able to go and see it because there will be restrictions, obviously, because of COVID. But there are ways to actually get and see the piece that June Caldwell has been speaking to us about this evening. Thanks for speaking to us tonight, June. And the exhibition is called Somebody, Niall O'Whelan, and a Book That Changed Us. Opens at the Museum of Literature Ireland on July the 20th, and you can find out all of the details, how to book your place, etc., on molly.ie. And that is our lot for this evening. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields researched. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Dave Gibson was on sound this evening, and tonight's programme produced by Sinead Egan. Talk to you tomorrow night at 7.